welcome to The Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. Perhaps you're just returning from your 4th of July getaway. Maybe you're tinkering with an itinerary that's just a few weeks off. Or it could be you have no definite plans yet. So let's focus on books about travel, because there's nothing like it to help recharge your spirit and re-energize your soul. It's the perfect time to hit the road, which my guest today did, only on two wheels. We'll hear about his bicycle trip across America. And if you're a bit slow off the blocks, I'm here to help with ideas. I've been researching new titles, some destination-based, others centering on an activity. You'll find them fun reads, whichever mirror your interests. I'm ready to roll, so let's turn to page one of the book report. Readers, let's begin today's book report with a cross-country hitchhiking journey alongside one of America's most beloved weirdos. In Carsick, John Waters sets out on his travels, armed with wit, a pencil-thin mustache, and a cardboard sign that reads, "I'm not psycho." So provisioned, he hitchhikes across America from Baltimore to San Francisco, braving lonely roads and treacherous drivers. But who should we be more worried about? The film director with genteel manners? Or the unsuspecting travelers transporting the Pope of Trash? What really happens when this cult legend sticks out his thumb and faces the open road? His real-life riders include a gentle 81-year-old farmer who is convinced Waters is a hobo, an indie band on tour, and the perverse filmmaker's unexpected hero, a young sandy-haired Republican in a Corvette. Carsick, performed by the author, is an unforgettable ride and a celebration of America's weird, astonishing, and generous citizenry.
Can I really give up the rigid scheduling I'm so used to in real life? Me, the ultimate control freak who plans weeks ahead the day I can irresponsibly eat candy? Sure, I've got all my interstate routes planned out for the trip, and I think I know how many truck stops there are and how far apart they are, but so what? Will I really get out of the car if my ride strays from my route but is still headed west? I keep thinking beggars can be choosers. But I have to open my mind to the possibility I may be wrong. "We are all bums," a radical left-wing poster boasted on the wall of my bedroom in my parents' house in the 60s. I remember the rage this particular slogan caused in my father. A bum, the worst thing you could be in his book. Now that he is sadly gone, can I finally become one? A vagabond? A freeloader? Is it possible to be a vagrant when you own three homes and rent another place in Provincetown for the summer? Will this book end up as a new spin on that now dated but incredibly influential 1961 nonfiction book, Black Like Me, where the white author, John Howard Griffin, hitched and rode buses through the South disguised as a black man to see how it feels to be discriminated against? I am afraid, just the way the Black Like Me man was, but of different things, like bad drivers. I'm amazed every person driving their car isn't killed every day. Riding along at high speeds in lanes just a few feet from each other? Texting, talking on the phone behind the wheel, or just plain driving while stupid? Nobody is really a safe driver. I worry my own involuntary backseat driving will cause problems for anyone who picks me up. Will cries of "slow down" or slamming imaginary brakes from the passenger side cause bad will with my host drivers? I'm never in the front seat of a car if I'm not behind the wheel, except when I take taxis in Australia, because I read the drivers there think you're snooty if you get in the back. Where I live in Baltimore, if you got in the front of the cab, they'd think you were robbing them and probably shoot you. I've had a good history with hitchhiking. It's hard to imagine today, but in the early 60s, my parents expected me to hitchhike home every day from high school. All the kids did. The roads were filled with preppy teenage boys, lacrosse sticks over their shoulders and their thumbs out. I'm sure just as many serial killers were behind the wheel then as now, but you never heard about them. Nobody warned us of the dangers of hitchhiking. Evil definitely did not seem to be lurking. My planned route is I-70 West, and if I'm lucky enough to get a ride going that way, I'll be able to find out if there really is such a thing as the Kansas City Trucking Company, Or was that just the title of a fictitious garage in that classic gay film directed by Joe Gage? I saw the real El Paso Wrecking Corp on my drive from El Paso to Marfa, Texas, and almost drove off the road remembering the sequel. If there really is such a place, maybe I can get dropped off there and make friends. I drove all 5 cross-country interstate routes in the United States when I was a young man and loved it. We used to get drive-away cars, where the owner gave you the keys and you paid the gas and delivered the car to an address on the opposite coast. I even remember singing America the Beautiful, stoned on hashish, with my fellow travelers, David Lockery, Steve Buto, and David Hartman, as we drove toward a beautiful sunset in Minneapolis. Looking back, I'm amazed anyone trusted any of us, considering how we looked at the time. But even though we violated the rules by taking other passengers and drugs, we always did deliver the car in one piece. But come to think about it, we didn't ever pick up a hitchhiker then, and that was in the heyday of the hippie years. And in 2012, I expect someone to stop? I still hitchhike in Provincetown to Longnook, the most beautiful beach in Truro, about 10 miles away. I usually ask someone to go on a thumbing date with me. Author Philip Hoare, artist and singer Kembra Fowler, the late and great art dealer Colin Delan have all joined me alongside the highway, and we've never had any real trouble either.
We've just heard Carsick by John Waters. Brian Benson grew up in the North Woods of Wisconsin. He's worked as a magazine editor, Spanish teacher, landscaper, and jazz musician. Brian now lives in Portland, Oregon, where he teaches writing at the Attic Institute. Going Somewhere, A Bicycle Journey Across America, is his first book. Welcome, Brian, and thanks for joining us on the Book Report.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on the show.
How did you begin planning your bike trip from Wisconsin to the West Coast?
Right. Planning is kind of a funny word. I didn't come up with the idea for the bike trip. I actually was traveling and ended up in Quetzaltenango, Guatemala, where I met a woman named Rachel and totally fell for her for many different reasons, not least of which was that she really knew what she wanted and where she wanted to go. And one of the things that she wanted to do is take a cross-country bike trip. And I had really no idea what I wanted to do at that point. I just knew that I wanted to be with her. And then I wanted to have something to focus on. And so when she brought that idea up, it just sounded like exactly what I didn't know I wanted to do.
All right. During the trip, you and Rachel had many magical moments, as well as plenty of frustrations with one another. Could any relationship survive such a journey?
Yeah, I think definitely. You know, ours certainly has, in that we're very, very close still. But, I think it's a really particular set of challenges that it places on a relationship. You know, I think in any relationship, once you really get to know a person or with them for a while, the little things start to crop up and present challenges. And you have disagreements over things that are said or not said, or just the tiniest little things. Like on this trip, Rachel lost a couple of chocolate bars that were gross chocolate, not even good chocolate. I was super upset about that. And I think that, and I realize how ridiculous that is, by the way, but I think that that kind of thing happens in any relationship, but it definitely gets exacerbated when you are sweaty and unshowered and probably malnourished most of the time. So I think it places a lot of strain on a relationship, but also really strengthens it because you get to see each other at your absolute best and worst.
Right. You described cycling alone as an orgy of freedom. Do you think ultimately you might have been happier doing the entire trip on your own as your friend Galen did?
I forgot that I described it that way.
Yes, you did.
I had these fantasies about what it would be like to ride on my own because I felt like I was the whole time trying to balance my love for Rachel and the joy of really being able to share it with her with just not just wanting to know what it would be like to do that on my own, but to do something on my own, to pick something and have the conviction to follow through on it. And since the trip in the book, I have actually done a couple of long cross-country rides on my own, and I loved those as well. But I can't say that one was better than the other. They were very different, and there were some moments when I rode alone that were just wonderful when I was out by myself and hadn't seen a car for a really long time and just knew that I was the only person in the world who knew where I was, and something about that felt really just fleeting and wonderful. But there were other times when I really wanted somebody to share it with, and definitely missed being out there with Rachel. So I don't think it's a better or worse. I think that there are huge benefits to both.
Right. Your trip was about 2 months long, the one you took with Rachel, and about 2,500 miles. Have you ever done an East Coast to West Coast trip?
I still have not. No, you know, I've ridden one more time now between Portland and northern Wisconsin, and I've also ridden from Portland down to San Francisco on some shorter trips as well, but I've not been on a bike, you know, long distance east of Wisconsin yet, and I would love to do that.
I have to ask you, have men and women reacted differently to the book? Because frankly, when I was reading the book, there were times I thought you were being a total jerk to Rachel.
Yeah, I really was, you know? The difficult part for me about writing the book was trying to be honest about what was going through my head versus what I was saying versus what I now think. And, you know, being able to honestly portray how I was being a jerk without apologizing for or condoning it from where I stand right now. You know, with narrative nonfiction, I think it's difficult, definitely, to separate the author and the character. And so, yeah, there have been some different reactions, but honestly, it hasn't been such a gendered thing. There have definitely been men who have said that exactly to me, like, what's wrong with you? Why were you being such a jerk?
Okay. Rachel was from Portland, and during your journey, she looked forward to returning there, but you seemed really ambivalent about getting to Portland, and yet you live there now. What happened?
Yeah, you know, I'd visited Portland with Rachel before we took the trip, and I loved Portland. Totally, totally loved it. But I was there, or here for about, I guess, a week and a half, and it was easy to just fall in love with it as a place to visit. But everywhere that I had been with Rachel was a place that she owned, you know. I met her in a city in Guatemala that she had been in for a long time before me. And then in Portland as well, you know, she had all these friends and these deep connections. And I met her when I was in a place of pretty deep insecurity, which I think also, you know, goes to explain some of the jerkiness that we were just talking about. But I really didn't feel comfortable with the idea of putting myself in a place that was so fully hers. And, you know, that definitely was an issue when we arrived. And I think that, you know, the fact that I'm here now is just a statement of having stuck around and built my own connections to the place. You know, my sister lives in Portland now as well, which definitely makes it feel a lot more like home. But I was definitely afraid of it the whole time we were riding.
We're speaking with Brian Benson on the Book Report. You wrote your trip was a messy collage of moments. Can you share a high and a low?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think one of the biggest lows would be just a variety of days riding in North Dakota and Montana. When, like we were talking about with the, you know, just the strains in the relationship, day after day of headwind, of not seeing many towns at all. We were just eating food from gas stations, so like not feeling super great because of that. We weren't really able to talk at that point because we'd been together 24 hours a day for weeks and had just run out of things to say to each other. And, you know, I remember thinking that I was going to have all these big, deep thoughts on the trip, but I just wasn't at that point having any thoughts at all besides the first verse of Home on the Range going through my head over and over again because we were in ranchland. So, yeah, you know, that I kind of felt like I had this big epic journey in mind, and then somehow that's how it ended up being, you know?
Right.
But, so, you know, that was a low point. There were so many high points. You know, one early in the trip that I can think of is we didn't plan our route really at all. We were committed to, you know, being individuals and avoiding amassing helpful resources, which was not really the best idea, but we did end up getting some really nice surprises. There was this bike trail that we happened upon in northern Minnesota that at that point was 85 miles. I think it's now 130. And it's not the rails to trails kind of conversion. It's actually a specific path built just for bikers that winds through the woods, beautiful part of Minnesota, and connects to all these small towns. And it was just this total surprise to end up there, and it felt like an amusement park built for us almost. And, you know, that was one of the biggest highlights, but there were so many moments like that where just by virtue of not knowing what to expect from not having planned it particularly well, we just got so pleasantly surprised.
You came across this great quote along the way. Life is not a journey to the grave with the intention of arriving safely in a pretty and well-preserved body, but rather to skid in broadside, thoroughly used up, totally worn out, and loudly proclaiming, wow, what a ride. I love that. Did you ever find out who wrote it?
Yeah, you know, I guess it's Hunter S. Thompson.
Oh, well, that would make sense, huh?
Right, yeah. You know, first when I looked it up, because Leanne, who had it up on her wall, she didn't have it attributed there. And I found it in a book about golf. I just, you know, Googled it really quick and assumed, okay, it was this guy who wrote a book about golf. But someone actually told me a little while later that it was from a Thompson book, which makes sense.
Do you have a website where people can get additional details about the trip?
If anybody's curious about that bike tour, they can find all the details on my website, which is brianbensonwrites.com. So BRIANBENSONWRITES.com.
What words of advice can you offer for folks who are considering a journey like yours?
So I think if I were to look at it now, what would be really a great way to do it is find a destination that's nearby to where you're at, like 30 miles, a place you'd like to go, a campground, something like that, and then try it out, you know? Have a nice, approachable ride, see how the weight feels on your bike. There are a bunch of resources online for what you should pack. You can just Google bike touring pack list and you find a million. But there's one by Ellie Blue, E-L-L-Y Blue, that she made a postcard online that is really great. You can just print the postcard up and it's got a really, really fun checklist of things that you're going to want to make sure to bring with. And so, yeah, you can do that and then just, you know, make notes when you do your trip of things that you wish you had and things that you wish you hadn't brought with. And that's probably the smart way to do it. What you could also do is what we did, which is just naively plan this thing and learn trial by fire and go much further than you have business going.
Thanks, Brian. It was great to read your book.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate this.
Alrighty. Bye.
Bye.
Obsessive Compulsive Cycling Disorder is an anthology of 30 articles written over 10 years by Dave Barter, an amateur cyclist. The collection exhibits the madness that engulfs those who descend into cycling obsession, celebrating the average cyclist living in a world defined by the pros. The writings range from fanciful musings concerning the Tao of single speeding to lengthy descriptions of end-to-end rides in Britain and Ireland. Mountain biking, road cycling, and all sorts of other cycling events are chronicled along the way. The lighthearted collection is narrated by Simon Whistler.
I can remember the moment clearly. At the age of 28, stepping into a mirror panels lift in a Birmingham hotel, I was wearing a tight-fitting white T-shirt and was treated to a 360-degree view of my midriff. It was huge, bulging out all over the place. It looked like a stirrup pump had been connected to my upper half and pumped vigorously until the skin was about to tear. Who was this portly fellow? Surely it couldn't be me. I was supposed to be a skinny wisp of a thing whose waist size always lagged behind my age. I felt for the label in my jeans and was reminded that it was at least six numbers ahead of my current longevity. Another glance at the mirrors confirmed that I'd officially joined the ranks of the wobbly. To make matters worse, I was slightly late and had to jog to the bar for an evening social with work colleagues. Fleshy saddlebags battered my sides as I puffed my way through Ronnie Scott's. It was as if my trunk was attempting to rotate the entire way around my spine. Something had to be done. I was about to leave my 20s, waist size heading for the 40s, and with most of the excess hanging off my hips and arse. Help was close at hand in my work colleagues. As soon as I'd come out as a tubby, they were happy to help by taking me running. The Post Office Research Center had a decent complement of runners, and some of them were pretty handy. I fell in with this crowd, and so began the ritual of a lunchtime jog. This replaced the previous ritual of the lunchtime jug of ale, which was probably the single greatest reason why I ended up in this state in the first place. After a few weeks of severe oxygen debt, the jog morphed into a run. Mile became miles. Stopwatch replaced wristwatch. Running shoes ousted the daps, and an obsession was born. 6 months later, the waistline was all but gone. I'd shaken it off all over Wiltshire, pounding pavements, paths, tracks, and byways in my quest to push it a little bit more. Then it happened, as it does to all who turn to running with a crowd. I was taken aside and quietly advised that it would be a good idea if I entered a race. This is the sport equivalent of the drug dealer upping the stakes from a sneaky lump of dope to full-on heroin injection. The race was a 10K held in the village of Highworth. My dealer advised that under 40 minutes would be an adequate time, and so the training stepped up to ensure that I wouldn't disappoint. 39 minutes, 47 seconds. Figures etched permanently into my memory as if it were the first time my body had done anything to make me remotely proud. I entered many other races and ran faster 10Ks, longer distances, and harder events. I was probably the only cinema-goer who cheered at the words, "Run, Forrest, run." It's what happened to me in the 90s. 3 stone of excess weight drove me to an obsession with sport that only increased as the weight disappeared. But Pete was waiting in the wings, a deadly weapon encased within his football boot, a weapon that would kill the obsession with running, only to resurrect it with something with a far greater price tag. Pete, unwittingly, turned me into a cyclist. Whilst running was my true love, she wasn't the first. I'd had a messy encounter with squash that ended badly when a schoolmate duffed me up for beating him fairly on the court. I sought solace in football, convincing myself that she'd not do me over, as there were 21 others who would probably get her attention first. I played 5-a-side for the works team. To qualify that further, I played 5-a-side for the works reserve of the reserves team. I was pretty crap. But being crap at something has never killed my enthusiasm for it. I still play guitar, bring up children, attempt to cook proper food, and turn my hand to DIY.
We've just heard Obsessive Compulsive Cycling Disorder by Dave Barter. Okay, we're veering off on a bit of a detour, but I'm sure this will entice travelers. Maps have long exerted a special fascination, both as works of art and as practical tools of navigation. But to those who collect them, the map trade can be a cutthroat business, inhabited by quirky and sometimes disreputable characters in search of a finite number of rare objects. Once considered a respectable antiquarian map dealer, E. Forbes Smiley spent years doubling as a map thief, until he was arrested slipping maps out of books at the Yale University Library. The Map Thief, the gripping story of an esteemed rare map dealer who made millions stealing priceless maps, delves into the untold history of this high-stakes criminal and the inside story of the industry. Reporter Michael Blanding interviewed all the key players in this stranger-than-fiction story and shares fascinating histories of maps that charted the new world. Sean Renette narrates.
E. Forbes Smiley III couldn't stop coughing. No matter how much he tried to suppress it, the tickle in the back of his throat kept breaking out into a hacking cough, drawing glances from the patrons sitting around him. The glass fishbowl of a reading room at the Beinecke Rare Book and Manuscript Library at Yale University was quiet except for the low hum of the air conditioning and the clicking of fingers on keyboards, making Smiley painfully aware of the noise he was making. At one point, he pulled a handkerchief out of his pocket to muffle the sound. As he did, an X-Acto knife blade wrapped inside fell softly onto the carpeted floor. He folded the cloth and put it back in his pocket, oblivious to what had just happened. Smiley was in the Beinecke this morning to study some rare atlases in preparation for the London Map Fair, an annual gathering of hundreds of map collectors who came to the British capital to buy, sell, and trade antiquarian maps. As one of the top dealers in the field, Smiley hoped to use the event to climb out of the financial hole into which he'd recently sunk. Over the years, he'd become expert at recognizing different versions of the same map from subtle typographical variations, an ability that could translate into thousands of dollars when deployed at the right moment. By refamiliarizing himself with some select maps, he hoped to be ready for any opportunity in London. So far, the trip hadn't gone well. The previous night, he'd woken up miserable in a cheap hotel. It wasn't the kind of place he'd usually stay. He favored luxury hotels, where he could see the look of surprise and interest flit across the faces of people when he let it be known he was a map dealer. He looked the part, too, with graying hair swept back over his ears and a long, oval face ending in a narrow patrician chin. A pair of silver wire-framed glasses perched on his nose, and he invariably wore tweed or navy blue blazers. That, along with his Yankee-sounding name, usually caused people to assume he was from old money, an impression Smiley did nothing to correct. When people thought of Forbes Smiley, as he was universally known by friends, dealers, librarians, and clients, a few words inevitably sprang to mind. Gregarious, jolly, larger than life. He spoke with the resonance of an Italian tenor mangled by a nasally waspish affectation. His voice, like Daisy Buchanan's, was full of money. When he made phone calls, he made sure to announce that he was calling from the vineyard. His upper-crust affectations, however, were tempered by a charming self-deprecation. He'd ingratiated himself with many a librarian by inquiring after her spouse or children, and reciprocated with entertaining stories of travels around the world or the progress of the new home he was building on the vineyard. Most of all, people thought of his laugh. For years, friends had reveled in Smiley's laugh, which rolled up out of his belly and racked his body in a cackle that only increased in volume the longer it went on. It was the kind of laugh that in college had earned him free tickets from theater producers, who sat him in the front row to egg on the audience. And it generally caused people to excuse the pretension that crept into his voice when he was expounding on any of his obsessions, architecture, New England history, the blues, and, of course, maps. Whether they liked him or not, his colleagues and rivals in the map business had all been seduced by his knowledge, which in certain areas exceeded that of anyone else in the world. On the morning of June 8, 2005, however, none of the librarians at the Beinecke's public services desk recognized him. Had they known him, they would have been shocked at the transformation he'd undergone. In addition to the cough that had developed overnight, he was suffering from a splitting headache left over from a night of drinking. Smiley had been drinking a lot these days. It was the only thing that took his thoughts away from the problems that multiplied in his mind whenever he was sober. As gifted as he was at remembering details about maps, he was abysmal at managing the details of the business through which he earned his livelihood. No matter how entertaining his stories, the truth was that he was overextended and hemorrhaging money. The stress had taken a physical toll, leading to a constant pain in his back for the past 2 years. This morning, it was particularly awful. Each time a cough racked his body, fresh bullets of pain rocketed up his spine.
We've just heard The Map Thief by Michael Blanding. Prize-winning author Michael J. Totten returns with Where the West Ends, stories from the Middle East, the Balkans, the Black Sea, and the Caucasus. Many call this a masterpiece of travel writing and history in lands just beyond the edge of the West. As an independent foreign correspondent, Totten's work often took him deep into the field beyond the sensational headlines, from miserable road trips to Iraq to the Wild West of Albania, from the killing fields in Bosnia and Kosovo to a Romania haunted by ghosts of its communist past. He even chronicles his time at the front lines in the Caucasus during Russia's invasion of Georgia and the otherworldly disasterscape in Ukraine that is a direct precursor to today's volatile situation. Stephen Roy Grimsley narrates.
I bought a map of Eastern Europe in an old Oregon bookstore that's as big as a couch when unfolded. The most heavily trafficked roads appear as fat red lines on the paper, almost all lead directly to Moscow. Even as late as the year 2012, the nerve center of the former Soviet Empire looks on my map like a world-devouring octopus, capturing less important capitals in its tentacles. On a cold night in late October, I pointed at a thin red line on that map, leading across the former Soviet frontier into Ukraine from a remote corner of Poland. "Hardly anyone will be on this road," I said to my old friend Sean Lafreniere. He had just met up with me in Romania so we could hit the road again. "We shouldn't have to wait long at the border." That logic seemed sound at the time, but I'm here to tell you, never, ever choose less-traveled roads in countries that used to be part of Russia. Driving from even the most backward country in the European Union into the remote provinces of Ukraine is like falling off the edge of civilization into a land that was all but destroyed. Sean and I hadn't learned that yet, though, and we wanted a scenic route. European road trips aren't like road trips in the American West where we live. Outside our major metropolitan areas, huge empty spaces and wide-open roads are the norm. Most of Europe is crowded, and neither of us wanted to sit in the car for hours in line at the border. We had no idea what we were in for, but a Polish border guard warned us after stamping our passports. "It is very strange over there," he said, "and nobody speaks English." Screwing up in the strange parts of the world is never fun and is usually miserable, but you learn things by doing it. You see things that governments and ministries of tourism wished you would not. Ukraine is so strange that you can even see things in the dark. We actually saw more of Ukraine's strangeness because we showed up in the dark. I don't remember what time we crossed the frontier, 8 o'clock in the evening? Anyway, it was dark. When I say it was dark, I mean it was dark. The back roads of western Ukraine are as black at night as the most remote parts of the American West, where no humans live in any direction. Yet, western Ukraine is not empty. And, oh God, the roads. I don't care where you've been. You almost certainly have never seen anything like them. The second worst road I've ever driven on was in Central America in the mid-1990s. It's only a fraction as bad as the road Sean and I took into Ukraine. This one would have been no worse off had it been deliberately shredded to ribbons by airstrikes. The damage was so thorough that the surface could not possibly have been repaved or repaired even once since the Stalinist era. I white-knuckled it behind the wheel while Sean cringed in the passenger seat. I did not dare drive faster than 5 miles an hour. Even at that speed, I had to weave all over the place to avoid the worst of the gaping holes, some of which were as wide as mattresses and deep enough to swallow TV sets. I saw no cars, no street lights, not even a single light from a house. Ukraine looked depopulated. My map said there were villages all over the place, but where were they? Did we just drive into an episode of Life After People? "This is exactly like Russia," Sean said. "Exactly." He had visited Russia 2 years earlier and will never forget the vast darkness at night on the train between Moscow and St. Petersburg. "We're in Russia," he said. Then the ghost figures appeared. They walked on the side of the road in wine darkness. They did not carry flashlights. They seemed like us to be out in the middle of nowhere. It was then that I realized we had entered a town. In the periphery of my headlight beams, I could faintly make out a few unlit houses shrouded in shadow away from the road, which was broken and crumbling as ever. I still hadn't seen any other cars on the road, nor did I see any parked on the side. I don't know if the roads were so bad because nobody drove, or if nobody drove because the roads were so bad. "They should put a sign up on the border," Sean said, "saying that was Europe. You like that? Now prepare for something completely different."
That was a sampling of Where the West Ends by Michael J. Totten. City girl Tori DeRoche wasn't looking for love, but a chance encounter in a San Francisco bar sparked an instant connection with a soulful Argentinian who swept her off her feet. The problem? He was about to cast off on a round-the-world voyage on his small sailboat. Tori was terrified of deep water. But she determined that to keep the man of her dreams, she must embark on the voyage of her nightmares. Love with a Chance of Drowning is a sometimes hilarious, often harrowing memoir set against a backdrop of the world's most beautiful and remote destinations. Candace Mall narrates.
My opportunity is ticking by, so in one clean swoop, I snatch up the wallet and locate his license. I remembered right. He is Ivan. Ivan Alexis Nepomniachtchi. It seems he was named by a cat walking across a keyboard. When I try to pronounce Nepomniachtchi out loud, my mouth sounds like it's full of peanut butter. 6 feet tall, blonde, green eyes, 31. 7 years older than me. His headshot is handsome, just as I remember thinking before I guzzled that damn martini like a cold beer on a hot day. A cupboard door slams in the bathroom, and I flinch, guilty and nervous. I work fast to slip the license back in the wallet, fumbling as I imagine what I'd say if caught. Yes, good morning, Ivan. What's that? Oh, you mean this wallet? No, I wasn't stealing anything. I just couldn't remember your name, so I... Oh, no, please don't call the cops. I don't even know myself right now. The license slides back in, and I toss the evidence away. But he doesn't come out of the bathroom, so I collect my clothes from beside the bed and throw them on. A pencil skirt, a turquoise silk blouse, a black sateen blazer. Feeling odd to be wearing yesterday's work attire at 8:30 a.m. on this Sunday morning. Head pounding, I collapse back into bed and try to work out when my memory became fragmented. It all began with a phone call. I was leaving a job interview when I heard an annoying ringtone following close behind me. Just before I spun around to see who was there, I noticed the ringing was coming from my handbag. The annoying ringtone was mine. It was my housemate calling, the only friend I had made since moving to San Francisco on my own from Australia a month before. A few weeks earlier, while staying in a hotel, I'd come across an ad for a shared house in the Western Addition. A seedy neighborhood, as it turned out. But after meeting the three down-to-earth housemates, plus a fourth four-legged roomie named Disco Dog, I decided to take it. Anna, a psychology student my age, won me over immediately with her odd ability to combine crass candidness with compassion. I flipped my phone open, silencing the annoying ringtone. Tori! Anna hollered down the line. What are you doing right now? I just had a job interview, I told her. On a Saturday? I thought you had a job already. I do, but this was for a position with The Onion. I couldn't resist applying. Yeah, it went well, but it occurred to me mid-interview that I can't spend my days designing black and white graphics. I'll go stir-crazy without color. Well, lady, you're in the right city then. Now, listen up. I want to introduce you to San Francisco. Come to Oysterfest and meet some of my friends. They'll adopt you immediately if you just shake their hands and say, throw another shrimp on the barbie. Got it? She gave me directions and I hung up the call smiling. At Oysterfest, the sun was shining, and apart from the gritty, oversized D-grade shellfish, my day was going superbly. The fun continued when Anna proposed a guided tour of the city's bars and restaurants, so we sipped our way across town, sampling everything from hot coffee mixed with vodka to sangria floating with fruit. After the last 6 months of stressing over whether or not I'd be able to land a job, find a home, make connections, and survive in a foreign city with only 2 suitcases and my entire life savings of $3,000, my anxieties were being silenced with clanking glasses and the laughter of new friends. Life was clicking into place. We had dinner in a Haight-Ashbury restaurant, and when the time came to go home, I congratulated myself for remaining clear-headed despite a day full of drinking. But that was about to change.
We've just heard Love with a Chance of Drowning by Tori DeRoche. In In Crossing the Heart of Africa, Julian Smith retraces the journey of the legendary British explorer who was the first man to cross the length of Africa in hopes of winning the woman he loved. In 1898, dashing young British explorer Ewart the Leopard Grogan sought out to prove his mettle to his beloved and her aristocratic stepfather. He began a quest to become the first person to walk across Africa. In 2007, 35-year-old American journalist Julian Smith faced a similar problem with his girlfriend of 6 years. He decided to address it in the same way Grogan had more than 100 years before. He was going to retrace the leopard's 4,500-mile journey for love and glory through the lakes, volcanoes, savannas, and crowded cities of Africa. Smith keeps you turning pages as he interweaves his own journey with Grogan's larger-than-life tale of charging elephants, cannibal attacks, deadly jungles, and romantic triumph. Michael Goldstrom narrates.
When Ewart Grogan pushed off into the White Nile 5 days before Christmas, 1899, the sun over southern Sudan fell on his back like a hot sheet of metal, and his diseased liver hurt so badly he couldn't stand up straight. His open boat groaned with supplies and sweating bodies. A dozen native soldiers, a small boy, a tall man from the Dinka tribe, an elderly Egyptian prisoner with a broken leg, and a mad criminal in chains. At full height, Grogan was 6 feet tall and strikingly handsome. He had a strong jaw, a narrow nose, and startling yellow-green eyes, which seemed to spark with intelligence and humor. It was because of that piercing gaze and his almost superhuman determination and endurance that Africans had nicknamed him Bwana Chui, the leopard. On that day, however, he was nearly unrecognizable, haggard, hunched, half-starved and baked brown by the sun. He had been traveling through Africa for almost 2 years. His route wound from the salty breezes of the Indian Ocean to the indigo lakes and smoking volcanoes of the Great Rift Valley, where the steep jungles teemed with pygmies and gigantic apes. Naked cannibals had pursued him for days near the lava beds of Mushari, and just a few weeks ago, he had celebrated his 25th birthday by fleeing a bull hippo for half a mile. Abscesses on his liver burst in blooms of agony, and a recurring malarial fever threatened to bake his brain. His only European companion had left for home 9 months earlier. For most of the journey, his only company had been a handful of African soldiers and porters who tended to desert at every opportunity, when they weren't busy plotting mutiny. And the worst was still ahead. Between him and his goal, a remote British outpost hundreds of miles downstream to the north, lay the most godforsaken swamp on Earth. The sud was tens of thousands of square miles of clotted vegetation and miasmatic air, home to the fierce giants of the Dinka tribe and cloud banks of insatiable mosquitoes. Hippos lurked in the black water, ready to snap canoes in half, and 6-foot marabou storks stalked across floating islands of green like reanimated corpses. If he made it to the outpost and then descended the Nile to Cairo, Grogan would join the ranks of legendary explorers like Sir Richard Burton, David Livingstone, and Henry Stanley. If he didn't, well, no one would ever know what happened. The swamp would swallow him without a trace. As the prow sliced the blood-warm water and high grasses hissed against the sides, Grogan was filled with uncertainty. He had no idea how far he still had to go, or whether Dinka warriors would ignore his tiny party or slaughter them. He didn't know if his band of reluctant volunteers would remain by his side, shoot him in the back, or abandon him to shrivel and starve in the sun. He was sure of one thing, though. He had to make it, because Gertrude was waiting. At age 22, 3 years before he pushed off into the Nile, Ewart Grogan was already a war veteran and world traveler who understood women. He knew the barmaids of Melbourne were the most beautiful in the world. He'd seen how difficult it was to tell the men from the women in Sri Lanka, and he had once killed a man barehanded in a bar fight over a Portuguese beauty. Grogan had just returned to England after serving as a soldier in Rhodesia, where he had fought in a bloody native uprising, and fallen so sick he had almost been buried alive. His doctors advised a long rest to convalesce. An extended sea voyage would be perfect. So when his friend Eddie Watt from Cambridge invited him to stay with his family in Napier on New Zealand's North Island, Grogan accepted.
That was Crossing the Heart of Africa by Julian Smith. Walking Home chronicles 19 days, 256 miles, and one renowned poet's trek. The wandering poet has always been a feature of our cultural imagination. The romantic poets tramped all over the Lake District searching for inspiration. Now, Simon Armitage, with equal parts enthusiasm, trepidation, and wry humor, takes on Britain's version of the Appalachian Trail, the Pennine Way. He walks the backbone of England by day, accompanied by friends, family, strangers, dogs, the unpredictable English weather, and a backpack full of Mars bars. Each evening, he gives a poetry reading in a different village in exchange for a bed. Armitage reflects on the link between freedom and fear, as well as the poet's place in our bustling world. Graham Malcolm narrates.
Poetry has always wandered. Many of our most revered poems are journeys. The Odyssey, the Canterbury Tales, Piers Plowman, and Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, to name just a few. And despite persisting images of the stop-at-home poet ensconced in the lonely garret, poets like Wordsworth and Coleridge ventured thousands of miles on foot in pursuit of ideas and inspiration. The Warsaw-born poet Ossip Mandelstam, writing about the relationship between the human stride and poetic rhythm, wondered how many oxhide sandals Dante had got through walking the goat paths of Italy as he composed his Divine Comedy, a work which in itself took him to hell and back. I am also a traveller poet, having gone as far as the Arctic Circle, the fjords of New Zealand's South Island, and the furthest tributaries of the Amazon River in search of poems, though more recently I have been exploring an area much closer to home. The Pennines, often referred to as the backbone of England, are a range of mountains running from the Scottish borders to the English Midlands on pretty much a north-south axis. Towards the southern end, they provide a natural divide between the counties of Lancashire to the west and Yorkshire to the east, counties which fought against each other during the War of the Roses and whose notorious rivalry continues to this day, though usually with less bloodshed. Further north, the Pennines separate the counties of Cumbria and Northumberland, with the Lake District lying to the west and the urbanised Tyne and Wear coastline to the east, before merging with the Cheviot Hills in southern Scotland. Hadrian's Wall, the famous Roman fortification which once formed the physical boundary line between England and Scotland, bisects the range towards its northern reaches. In many ways, the word Pennine is synonymous with the word North, conjuring up images of England's industrial heartlands, as well as bleak and remote upland tracts. But the North is something of a confusing term in British geography, perhaps in the same way that the American Midwest to the foreigner seems neither particularly mid nor especially west. Outsiders looking at a map of Britain tend to see a long by narrow landmass, roughly 600 miles from top to bottom and a couple of hundred miles wide. From that point of view, suffice it to say that the Pennines are roughly in the middle. The mountains of the Pennines are not particularly tall, and by some definitions not even mountains, Cross Fell being the highest at just short of 3,000 feet, and are often referred to as fells, pikes, or simply hills. But towards their upper slopes they are sparsely populated, even uninhabitable, and in winter they often form an inhospitable landscape and occasionally an impenetrable barrier to traffic and travel.
Their unique characteristic is that of moorland, and I say unique because, for all my wanderings, I have never come across anywhere in the world which resembles the moors of my own country. These are wide and undulating expanses of high altitude, treeless hillsides, often boggy, usually with very poor or peat soil, incapable on the face of it of sustaining anything but the hardiest of grasses or the most adaptive of species. Sheep graze there, and crows perch on the rocky outcrops, and yet, like all supposed wildernesses, a closer study reveals a rare and threatened habitat, a sanctuary for all kinds of unusual life forms, and a vital organ in the country's environmental anatomy, filtering its water and purifying its air. But desolate, nonetheless, and lonely and dangerous, which of course only adds to the moor's intrigue and the desire to visit them once in a while.
We've just heard Walking Home by Simon Armitage. Poets, actors, athletes, explorers, and wanderers. I feel certain we've covered at least one category that's your perfect fit. If you still haven't found the right literary travel companion, check my website, bookreportradio.com, for news-making titles across a world of genres. Thanks for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.